Our speaker tonight is author, teacher, and activist Derek Jensen. He is the author of Listening to the Land, A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, Strangely Like War, Welcome to the Machine, and Walking on Water. These books take sensitive and critical looks at such difficult topics as violence, child abuse, racism, environmental destruction, surveillance, education, creativity, and the ways that these issues are all related to each other. His upcoming books, Endgame, Volumes 1 and 2, are due out this summer from Seven Stories Press. They are anticipated to be powerful commentaries on the suicidal tendencies of this disintegrating culture and the possibilities for resistance, adaptation, and change. Derek Jensen's radically honest writing inspires people to reflect on the ways that we relate to each other and to the world around us, weaving together the personal, the political, the historical, and the philosophical. He writes moving and deeply personal critiques of the destructiveness of civilization and the impact that it has on our lives and the environment. Though he explores deep wounds, he also provides hope for healing. I would now like to welcome the person who has been called a rare and original voice of sanity in a chaotic world, Derek Jensen.
Before we start, I would like to thank Santa Cruz Freak Radio, 101.1 FM. KZSC, Sacramento Prisoner Support, Little Ghost Fingers for their excellent set, all the Santa Cruz folks who helped put this on, and in specific I would like to mention Stasha, Nick, Petey, Ariel, and the fellow who brought me this wonderful jug of well water, and also the sound person, and also the person who was putting up all the chairs, who was, I don't know his name, but he was in here a few minutes ago, and I would like to thank him too. That's a lot of work. Vincent? Vincent? Okay, so I would like to thank Vincent as well. And I would like to thank all of you for showing up. I really appreciate that. And I would also, sort of having to do with Earth Liberation Prisoners, I would like to thank everyone who keeps their mouth shut. I think that's a very good thing. Okay, so we have a few options that we could do. God, isn't that funny? You know, I'm the one who's going to be talking. It's like we. Okay, so we have a few choices as to what I could talk about. And so what I was thinking, actually, is that I would lay out those choices, and then since we live in a democracy, which is actually my best joke of the night, that I would, of course, lay out the predetermined choices, and then you could vote. And then I would ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. But I figured I would just go ahead and cut to the chase and start off by doing whatever the hell I want to do. I have in my hands an extremely rare first draft of the film script for the movie Star Wars. And I don't know if you know this, but the movie was originally written by environmentalists and has a pretty dramatically different plot than the movie as it was finally made. And as most of us know, the way the movie really ended up is that, you know, sort of at the end, there's this Death Star, this huge machine that is capable of destroying entire planets, which, of course, is a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture. And the Death Star then moves up. It's going to destroy another planet, and it moves up, And then Luke Skywalker, if you recall, uses the Force to fly past all the TIE fighters and then get in and drop a torpedo down through an exhaust pipe and blow up the whole Death Star. I mean, you basically remember that, right? Yeah, I mean, Star Wars came out at about the right time for me. I was in high school, and which is a perfect time. And I really liked the movie a lot back then. I mean, I wasn't one of those nerds who watched it 400 times or anything. Besides, I was way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. But anyway, that's actually not how the first draft went. The draft, as written by the environmentalists, the rebels do not, of course, blow up the Death Star, but instead they use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support its decision that blowing up a planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors, and will leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. And scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it is imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, and they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, you and I both know that all of this should be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on a planet's about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few rebels sneak aboard the Death Star and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. There's a big debate held. There's a stirring debate has held on screen among the rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels never are able to come to consensus. Which, by the way, is how I know that there's never going to be an anarchist revolution. Well, there's two reasons. One way I know that there's never going to be a revolution is because of this. Because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. And the reason I know there won't be an anarchist revolution is because a few years ago I was down in Florida doing a talk, and afterwards, probably 10 or 11 of us were going to go out to dinner, and we spent 45 minutes in the parking lot trying to come to consensus on who was going to get in which car. And the only way we were ever able to break the deadlock was this one woman finally said, okay, look, you three this car, you four this car, you four this car. We're like, okay, cool. So that's how the revolution's going to come, is some woman she's got to call it. Okay, so once inside the Death Star, a splinter group of rebels breaks off from those about to lock themselves down, and they rush down long hallways, somehow avoiding all the troopers. They burn a couple of transporters and use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And that group miraculously escapes back to the planet about to be destroyed, where, of course, they're held by the peaceful protesters. They can immediately and rightly be turned over to the troopers. Okay, near the end of the movie, another debate is held among the rebels. And that's a problem I had with this screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate, not quite enough action. But, of course, that's just art imitating life. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back, and they're generally shouted down by the pacifists, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must, above all else, have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, this will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. And he doesn't mention, though, whether those tears would be of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up and tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels, even those who previously had been in favor of surgical strikes aimed at removing Darth Vader, are horrified. They remind those four that the Death Star has a crew of 265,675. And in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca on one side and everybody else on the other. And then all the normal activists chase those four from the room and from the film, which is not a big deal since they're minor characters anyway. Okay, so then what happens is the Death Star looms closer and closer to the planet. And so you see a shot of the Death Star, then you see the planet, then you see the Death Star, then you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red. And they just get brighter and brighter. And then you see the planet, and then you see this little speck of light take off. And that, of course, is the environmentalist getting away before the planet's blown up. And then the planet gets blown up. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this is for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times devoting a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. Yes, we got some press. So I was doing a Q&A. I was doing a talk in Asheville, North Carolina a couple years ago, and afterwards someone in the audience asked, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, sure, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. I was asking you the question. I was like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And so that night in my hotel room, I was sort of fixating on the question, which says a lot more about my social life than I wanted to. And I came up with an answer. How many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? 10. 1 to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change. 4 to circulate online petitions. 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that that's the only way that real change occurs. 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself. Apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people are afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large that you would hear them long before you would see them? Or maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons, so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, so large that they were as loud as thunder, moving 60 miles an hour. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews, just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take 90% of the large fish in the oceans being gone. You know, what's it going to take, Derek? What's a threshold? Give me a threshold at which you're finally going to use that word. Thanks, George. So what I'm doing with Endgame is, or one of the things I'm doing is I'll back up a second. I ask people all over the country, do you believe that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And the answer is the same as at least a couple people in the front row with chuckles. Oftentimes people laugh out loud. It's absurd. And one time, one of my talks, one guy raised his hand, everybody looked at him, and he said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to go undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. One of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And so this book is really about that change in strategy and tactics. And one of the things I do in the book is I attempt to lay as many of my premises out as I can in boldface, because I don't want to slide premises by people. One of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And I don't want to cheat like that. And a really good example of that would be you hear some talking head on television say, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Huh, that's a good question. How can we make the U.S. economy grow? But premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And another example of this might be Hitler. Hitler asks, so what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? God, that's a good question, Adolf. What are we going to do about it? But premise, there's a Jewish problem that you have to do something about. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And once again, I don't want to slide my premises by people. And of course, there are going to be premises that are inherent in the English language. And there are going to be premises that escape me, absolutely. And there are going to be premises inherent in writing a book. For example, a book is supposed to have a beginning, middle, and end. And one of the things I do about that is in the acknowledgments. I mean, that's a problem. But in the acknowledgments, I say that. I say, I acknowledge some of those who have helped. And then I say all these acknowledgments are, in a sense, premature. It's customary after finishing a book for authors to acknowledge in print all those who helped bring the book to fruition. But this book isn't yet finished. If it's to be more than mere words, this book will only be complete when this culture of death no longer impels life on the planet. At that point, the acknowledgments and gratitude will flow like rivers rushing through canyons once blocked by now crushed dams. So premises. Actually, before we get to premises, I want to talk about one more thing, and then we'll jump into premises. And that's several years ago, an environmentalist friend of mine said to me that he thinks that one of the problems is that a lot of environmentalists really don't know what they want. And he was a forest activist, and he was contrasting that with the people who run timber corporations who do generally know exactly what they want. I mean, do environmentalists want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, fewer clear cuts? Do they want there to be a functioning democracy? Do they want for the Giants to win the series? And yes, it would be nice if we still had a world. What is it that we, they, whomever want? And I'm really clear on what I want, at least. And I can't speak for anyone else here or anywhere else, but I know what I want, which is that I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon in it every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more large fish in the center of the oceans every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that's not being dismantled. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. I will do whatever it takes to get there. We'll talk more about whatever it takes in a while. Okay, so the first premise of this book is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. couple things about that. One is, several years ago, I was riding in the car with a friend of mine, George Draffin, with whom I've written a couple of books, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And he was in a terrible mood, and he said, you know, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question really is what's going to be left of the world when we get there. And, okay, so let's talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about that. Well, first off, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't going to last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out, generally. And, I mean, for example, if you have an economy that's based on, I don't know, oil, to choose a random example, and there's a finite amount of oil, eventually you're going to run out. And that way of living will no longer be able to continue. And you would think that if one were reasonably intelligent, that one would begin to ask how one will live when that non-renewable resource is no longer available, theoretically. And similarly, it's the same with the use of renewable resources, that if every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually there won't be any. As like if every year there are fewer passenger pigeons than the year before, eventually there won't be any. I mean, there were so many passenger pigeons. There were more passenger pigeons than there were of all other birds combined in North America. And of course, they're all gone now. I've been all gone for a long time. But they were cheap. And, you know, we're all taught in school that evolution is based on competition. And that's really stupid. I can do a one-sentence disproof of that if you'll give me a couple semicolons. Which is, those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run. Semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. Semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually giving your habitat what it needs. Like salmon do. Like everybody does but us. The Talua, I live on Talua land in what's now far northern California, and the Talua lived there for 12,000 years if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talua, then they lived there since the beginning of time. And, oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll talk about this in a second. But there's one more thing, actually. There's something else, another place I have to go before I go to the place I have to go before the Talua thing, which is that, and you're seeing why my books are written in nonlinear fashion, which is that I'm really hot. Okay, so we're gonna see how much we raise tonight. The socks will go next. Oh, geez, somebody's reaching for a wallet. I would go further than saying that any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation of non-renewable resources can't last. I would go further than that, and I would say that any way of life based on the use of resources can't last. And the reason I would say that is because salmon don't consider themselves resources. Resources don't actually exist. Salmon are fish. Trees don't consider themselves a timber resource. They're trees. And that doesn't mean you can't eat them or otherwise use them. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And this is true across the board. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'm going to treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. A resource is there to be used, as opposed to, and that's true whether the resource is gold, fish, timber, or vaginas. And, ooh, you know, that's another thing. And we'll talk more about this probably later, too. But I really hate the word vagina. You know what it means? It means a sheath for a sword. Yeah, exactly. So, a few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and this guy, the interviewer, said, you know, Indians exploited salmon, too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave him respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I was required by law to answer his question. And that afternoon, I went out, and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon. And it's like I got in an argument with this guy a few years ago because he was saying that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser for deforestation. And I didn't think that was right. And he said, well, go ask a tree. And I said, I did. I asked a tree. And the tree gave me, well, the tree didn't give me the answer, but the tree said something to me immediately, which is, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And I thought it was really good. But then I also realized that I am culpable for deforestation, but not because I consume the flesh of trees. I'm culpable for deforestation because I consume the flesh of trees, but I don't stop Weyerhaeuser from deforesting. I'm culpable because I consume the flesh of trees without taking responsibility for the continuation of their community. And everybody knows this. Herons know it. Tadpoles know it. Bears know it. Everybody knows. And this isn't just a woo-woo thing. This is on a real physical level. If the mergansers eat all the newts in this pond, they won't have any newts next year. So I've witnessed this in a pond right near my home. Is the newts will come through, and they'll eat a bunch, or the mergansers will come through, and they'll eat a bunch of newts, and then they won't come back for a couple years. And the newt population will start back up, and then they'll come through, they'll eat some newts, and then, anyway, so. How we perceive the world affects how we treat the world. How we perceive those around us affects how we treat them. So that's really central to that. But that's fine, Derek. But you still haven't talked about the whole sort of culture. What does that mean for the whole thing? You know, why does that mean that civilization is not and can never be sustainable? You know, I've been bashing civilization for, God, 10 or 15 years now. And with this book, I decided I probably better finally define it. And so I've defined civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. That's very nice, Derek, but what is a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is the Talua were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages and camps. They lived there, as I said, for 12,000 years at least. And they didn't require the importation of resources. They ate salmon, huckleberries, elk, clams, marine mammals, salmon. And then usually through the winter months, they would eat quite a bit of salmon. But they didn't require the importation of resources. And consequently, well, okay, so two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, and I know resource, nasty word, but I'm just going to use it. So as your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area of that particular resource. It can never be sustainable. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because no matter because if you require the importation of that resource, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. If the people in the next watershed over have that resource and they're not going to trade you for it, if you require it, you're going to take it. And what this means is we could all become wonderful green capitalists, and this way of living would still not be sustainable. And we could also become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because otherwise there's no way for them to get access to the oil that's necessary to run the economy that just happens to be under somebody else's land. And it's like with A Language Older Than Words, I tried to show that the culture is really irredeemable from a psychological perspective. And we can go into that or not later, as the case may be. And with Culture Make-Believe, I tried to go into why the culture is irredeemable from sort of a social perspective, that as long as you have the social system of rewards that's in place, the system will lead inevitably to atrocity. And with the new book, I tried to sort of show how the culture is irredeemable on the level of physical movement of resources. Once again, we can all just have the most pure and wonderful hearts, and so long as you still need to get what's the stuff that's used for cell phones that is comes from Africa? Coal? Coltan, yeah. So long as cell phones require coltan, and so long as coltan comes in an area that is home to chimps, is it not, or is it? It's gorillas. Okay, yeah. As long as it's home to gorillas, fuck them. You know, we need it. And end of story. And we can all, you know, we can all use our cell phones to talk about the latest green technologies, and it doesn't matter. So long as it requires coltan, the gorillas are screwed. Actually, I've seen apes use cell phones quite often, but not gorillas. The ones that do use cell phones are often called Homo sapiens sapiens, and the reason they put the second sapiens on there was to make sure we got the joke. Anyway, so that's the first premise of the book: is this way of living is not and can never be sustainable. We can't just, you know, make a patch here too and make the thing work. Second premise of the book. It's like, holy shit, we're like 40 minutes in. He's got this. That's premise one's right there. It's like, so you all brought sleeping bags, right? The second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. And all of my indigenous friends are saying, yeah, it took you a while to figure this one out, didn't it? The third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. And this is true on every level. I mean, of course, it's true on the level of violence to the natural world, violence to those who resist having their land bases destroyed. And it's true on a more sort of a level that's intimate to most of us. And there was a guy after a talk I did a couple years ago who said, you know, you talk a lot about violence, but I just don't see it. You know, I don't see how there's violence in my own life. It's just not there. And I said, well, first off, where's your shirt made? And he looked, and it's made in Bangladesh. It's like, okay, do we even need to talk about that? It's like, no, I get it. I said, okay, second, I'm just curious, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own? And I said, no. What I mean is, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, I get evicted. I said, I don't know what that means. What does that mean that you get evicted? And he said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. I said, okay, stop. Okay, the sheriff comes to your house. What would happen if when the sheriff comes to your house, you say, hey, I'm about to have dinner. Come on in. So you invite him in, and you feed him dinner, and oddly enough, you don't poison him. And that was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft, or Mr. Gonzalez. You can put away the electrodes. Anyway, so you invite him in, and you have dinner. And then after dinner, you say, you know, your company has been somewhat pleasant, but really not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave now. What would happen? He said, well, he would pull out a gun, and he would say, you haven't been paying your rent, so I'm here to evict you. I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your home. He's like, yeah. I said, do you ever get hungry? He said, yeah. I said, when you're hungry, do you ever go to the grocery store? There's lots of food there. And he says, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, what would happen if you're really hungry? So you go to the grocery store and you start eating food. What would happen? He said, well, they'd call the sheriff. He said, yeah, he'd come with a gun. The same guy probably. He's a real asshole, isn't he? And the point is that in order to exist on the planet, in order to sleep in a place, and in order to eat, to take nourishment into your body, you have to pay someone. And if you don't pay someone, somebody's going to come with a gun and do something bad to you. So part of the reason that our lives sometimes don't have violence is because we're going along with this system where you have to pay in order to survive. Okay, fourth premise of the book, and this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. I mean, there's a whole culture worth of examples of this. You know, my own father was extremely violent. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because my brother had committed blasphemy. The violence had gone up the hierarchy, which it should never do. Another example of this would be, Jaws or Spring Break Shark Attack. It was a movie made like a year and a half ago. It's like, God, I wish I was at my shark still in the world. But the ratio, I mean, it's like, you know, I watched Jaws about the same time I watched Star Wars, and, you know, I'm still fucking afraid to get in the water. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally about 20 million to one. Or where I live, I live in the forest, and I oftentimes walk through the forest at night without a lantern or anything. And there's bears up there. I was like, oh my God, aren't you scared? There's bears. I mean, they're like big, and there's about one person dies in North America every year because of a black bear attack. And let's contrast that with, I believe it's 42,000 Americans die every year in automobile wrecks. And I believe it's about the same number die every year from the health results, the direct result of automobile emissions. And so, I mean, you know, it's like bears. I mean, well, who the fuck's scared of a bear? I mean, we should walk through a parking lot going, oh my God, stay away. Or another example of this would be, of course, 9/11. I mean, when was the last time you ever heard a political speech that did not mention 9/11? Well, I guess it was probably 9/10. And there were what, it was like 3,000 Americans died? There's 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. I don't remember what the number is for how many Americans die every year because of, all those numbers I've given you so far are right on, but the next one I'm going to make up because I don't remember what it is. It's like, I don't know how many Americans die because of unsafe working conditions every year. 50,000 Americans, or 500,000 Americans, 3 million. Every American dies every year because of unsafe working conditions. I mean, it's more Americans die from unsafe working conditions every year than die.
6,000 or 2,001.
You know, I was looking it up today, and I read about that number today, and I don't believe it because I read a much bigger number a while ago, and the bigger one's got to be right. No, I mean, actually, a place to look is endgame.org, which has nothing to do with my book. That's I sort of stole this title from my friend George Straffen, who runs the endgame.org site, and he has on there some other references to larger numbers if you want to, like, use larger numbers to pad up your, you know, how scary it is. But even if it's 6,000, it's still twice as many. 6,000 is what you said, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then it was kind of several million
injured. Right. But once again, we don't talk about those. Or what about, we're back to real numbers now. I believe 1 million infants die every year from the direct result of so-called debt repayment. But of course, those are invisible. All those deaths are invisible, as opposed to any death that goes up the hierarchy. And does anybody mind if I swear? Okay. My mom is really supportive of my work, but whenever she comes to one of my talks, afterwards on the way home, it's always the same thing, which is, you know, did you have to say the F word quite so much? But we have some very important analysis of the F word here, which is, and it relates to this whole premise four of you know, hierarchy, of violence goes down the hierarchy. And that's, I think that fuck is the most amazing word in the English language because it's all of patriarchy condensed into four letters. I mean, how strange is it? How twisted is it that the same word that means do great violence to means make love to? I mean, so somebody says to me, you know, I'm going to fuck you. It's like, I need some more information. And so, I mean, that's bad enough, but then you get a couple other things. One is I used to teach in a prison and at Pelican Bay, and one of the things that any guy thinks about when he thinks about prison at all is of course the possibility of getting raped. I mean, not me as somebody going in to teach, but you know, when you think about prisons, like that's the first thing. I mean, it's a stock joke in sitcoms, and it's in every prison movie since Cool Hand Luke, excluding Cool Hand Luke. And there's an interesting thing about the rate at which men are raped in prison, which is it's lower than the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large, which means when it happens to a man, at least it's noticeable. When it happens to a woman, of course, in many states, it's not even a crime if they're married. And so when I was doing culture make-believe, I looked up rape. I did a search, an internet search for the word rape. And the most common type of site that I found was not rape crisis hotlines or scholarly analyses or police reports or anything like that. The most common site that I found, of course, was pornography. And I mean, this is getting really, really weird. And then we're going to add another layer to this, which is there's a great line by Catherine McKinnon. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. I love that line. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And it's so, the objectification of women is so inherent in our language that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's still almost impossible to not objectify the woman. So the man says to the woman, I would really like to be inside of you. You know what just happened? She's the object of the sentence. Okay, so then the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside of me. You know what happened? She's still the object of the sentence. So the man says to the woman, I would like for you to be around me. And she's like, I'm sorry, can you speak English? I'm not sure what you're wanting here. And all of this, you know, when you combine the routine, the everyday, the ubiquitous objectification of women and the strange conjunction of sex and violence within a patriarchy, when you combine that with the premise four of the book here, which is that violence can only flow down the hierarchy, suddenly that helped me to understand homophobia, which is something I'd never understood before. It was always really, really clear to me that if you don't like homosexuals, you just shouldn't date one. But this all sort of started to come clear to me when, in the whole beginning of the Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing, when some spokesman for the military said, and this is a direct quote, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? I said, well, yeah, I can imagine that, but that wasn't his point. And he said it would destroy chain of command. And notice he didn't say if a lieutenant had sex with a private. He said if a private had sex with a lieutenant. So the point is that when you have subject, verb, object, and when you have sex and violence getting conflated, and when you can have violence only flowing one direction, that means that there has to be a fucker and a fuckee. And the fucky always has to be the recipient. And when you have both the fucker and the fucky being male, all the little tiny brains just explode. So suddenly I got it. And that also helped me understand, I only got this one a couple days ago, that helped me understand why the sort of religious right will often talk about homosexuality as blasphemy. And of course it's blasphemy, because if you perceive sex and violence, as if you conflate them, and you're sending that violence up the hierarchy instead of down, that's blasphemy. So we'll get off that now. Anyway, this is, I think, one of the smartest things I wrote in this book, if I do say so myself, is that I mean, it's really changed how I perceive everything in this culture about how violence can only flow down. That's why, I mean, like, between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. And, I mean, I'm sorry, did we hear about that? But at the same time, any time a cop dies, it's like, there's a big state funeral with, you know, some gave all gave some with the bumper stickers. You know, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Way, way, way more dangerous than cops. And when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for a garbage collector, you know, or bumper stickers, you know, some gave all gave. And when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man who's cleaning up the mean streets of L.A., you know? It doesn't happen because that's not, you know, pushing the violence in the one direction. And then, of course, when it goes the other direction, you know, if anybody, you know, sort of, oh, there was like this. That's a great example. This actually happened not very long ago, maybe a year ago. There was a guy who I believe is in Oklahoma, and I believe I got the facts basically right, but he, and if I have a little bit off, somebody can correct me, and I'll just tell you to get the hell out of here. This guy, I think, got 7 years for beating his wife, maybe even beat her to death, and then he later spat on a cop, and for spitting on the cop, he got life in prison. And of course, that's exactly the way it should be, because that's violence going up the hierarchy. I've sort of beaten that one to death. Now I'm going to move on. Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Thanks for that chuckle back there. You know, I've been saying this one for like a year and a half, and I love that line about this is called justice, and you're the first person who's actually laughed at it, so I just thank you for that. That makes my night. Okay, sixth premise of the book. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to eviscerate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worst things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If Columbus would have turned back, you know, Columbus was supposed to turn back, actually. His crew mutinied, and he said, give me 2 more days. And they gave him 2 more days, and on the night of the second day, they saw the beach. They were going to turn back. If they would have turned back, and maybe, you know, if this culture would have been stopped, if Tecumseh would have won and, you know, driven the whites back off the continent, or if, you know, if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, people in the Midwest would still be able to eat passenger pigeons. I mean, just disregarding, you know, passenger pigeons living for themselves. If people would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest would still be able to eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the Columbia River 40 years from now. They'll be glowing, for one thing. And they'll be starving to death. And they'll be saying, there are no salmon because you didn't take out the dams that are killing the salmon. God damn you. Just on the level of, I mean, what's going to happen in 40 years? Is somebody going to be saying, God, I wish they would have brought it back down, brought it down then because there would have still been, you know, earthworms? You know, I don't know what. You know, what's the next thing to go? If somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry about global warming. If somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry about dioxin in every mother's breast milk, flame retardant in every mother's breast milk. You know, the longer we go, the worse things are going to be. The eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just made it impossible for me to hold any public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. this isn't a premise, but this is something that has become increasingly clear to me, that the only measure by which we will be judged will be the state in which we leave the natural world. People who come after, the human people who come after, are not going to care about whether we voted or did not. They're not going to care about whether we signed petitions or we didn't sign petitions. They're not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're going to not care whether we took down dams or didn't take down dams. They're not going to care about whether we designed groovy eco-villages or whether we came up with this wonderful eco-socialist utopia with free love all around. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and whether they can eat the food and whether they have a land to live on. Thanks. That's the one measure by which all generations of people have been measured by those who come after. Okay, the ninth premise of the book is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of those ways would be characterized by extreme violence, nuclear Armageddon, for example, and others would be characterized by less violence. I'll talk about population for a couple minutes. First off, I need to say I don't think that population is a primary problem. I want to say something else before that, which is it's really clear to me, and I think it's clear to a lot of people, that humans have exceeded carrying capacity. And carrying capacity is the it's the number of a specific type of creature that can be supported on a specific piece of ground forever. So you could have an island that could have a carrying capacity of 1,000 of a certain type of deer, and you could have 1,000 deer there forever. But if you have 5,000 deer on that, they're going to denude the vegetation, they're going to cause erosion, they're going to permanently decrease carrying capacity. And before we go on, you know, I know it's always said that there are no stupid questions, but I actually got one the other day. I was talking about carrying capacity, and it was on a radio station. There's this guy who just hates my guts, and every time I'm on this radio station, he always calls up to chew me out about something. And this time, the thing he wanted to chew me out about is he said, "How could you possibly say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care?" Well, that's quite possible, too, but that's an entirely different discussion. Okay, but having said that, yes, it's clear to me that humans have exceeded carrying capacity, but that doesn't mean that I think that overpopulation is a primary problem. One of the reasons for that is because actual numbers don't mean anything. What's most important is the amount of damage that's caused. You could have 100 gazillion deer on that one island, and it wouldn't matter if they didn't eat shit or stand anywhere. But the problem comes when you consume and when you create waste. And when I think of overpopulation, usually what I think of is little brown babies with big bellies in third world cities. And I like to talk about overconsumption and that being more of a problem, because who actually causes more damage, that little baby or, you know, the average American? And I think the answer to that one's pretty clear. But actually, I don't even consider population to be a secondary problem, because I consider it to be a tertiary problem. And the reason it's a tertiary problem is because I really hate demographers. And the reason I hate demographers is because oftentimes they talk about a natural rate of population expansion, and they somehow end up presuming that humans breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think rabbits breed like rabbits. That presumes that people don't make rational family planning decisions based upon their social and personal and cultural context. And if you're raised within a culture that refuses to acknowledge limits and refuses to even perceive damage to the natural world, it's like when I said, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, the response to that, I didn't say it, I mean, somebody else said it, I didn't say it, to the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service, the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service's department overseeing the murder of the oceans, his response to learning that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and this is pretty much a direct quote, is we have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. And so when you're within a culture that absolutely doesn't perceive damage to the natural world, it becomes much more possible for you to have more children than you might otherwise. And when you have a culture that's based on the ideology of growth, a culture in which you have, I don't remember where I read this, there's some book I was reading where it was talking about how people are supposed to be fruitful and go forth and multiply or something. And when you have a culture that book is on the bestseller list, that's going to, one that people within that culture are going to be more likely to have babies. There was actually to have too many babies. And there was actually, people may not believe this, but many of the cultures, maybe the Native American cultures, were more or less steady state. I mean, the Tala, once again, lived there for 12,000 years. And one of the reasons many of them were steady state is because I think the numbers between 250 or 300, there were between 250 and 300 different types of plants used for contraception among Native American women. And this is so funny. I love this. This has nothing to do with anything, but it's just a story I love to tell. That there was a time when a lot of male anthropologists were going to various indigenous cultures and asking about contraception. And they were asking the males. And they were then writing all these papers about how these people know nothing of contraception, but still they end up not having babies. And it's a mystery. And then about 20 years later, there started to be female anthropologists who would go talk to the women. And of course, this was female knowledge. I mean, the men's like, I don't know why they don't have babies. You know, and the women are like, well, you know, you eat this one root when you're 16, you don't have a baby for 5 years, and when you're 21, you got it, blah, 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 blah. This has nothing to do with anything, but it's a really fun story. Okay, so someday there will be far fewer humans, and every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation to a different way of living, and every cell in my body wants for humans to voluntarily stop overpopulating and overconsuming. You know, it's like, you know, if I ran for president, it would be on the platform of, you know, vasectomies on the house or something. You know, it's like everybody gets a vasectomy. I guess it wouldn't work. I mean, every man gets a vasectomy, but only one. I got to be able to somehow. It's like a chicken in every pot. We could say a vasectomy in every. Vasectomy in every. Oh, that's too nasty. I can't say that. Every cell in my body wants for that to be voluntary, but it's not going to happen. You know, I mean, it's like we're already over the cliff, and we're over the cliff, and we stop and hit the brakes. And what are we going to do about that? And this raises a huge, 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 and important question. There was this. I was doing two talks in one day in Eugene, Oregon, and this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both of my talks. And at both of them, she was very, very upset, and she said, you know, she called me a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. her reasoning was that because I want to bring down civilization, that I hate humans, and that and bringing down civilization would kill a lot of people. And I actually have a couple of answers to that. And the first one is that, well, the three answers. I mean, the first one is I don't hate people. If I did, I'd probably run for national office.